You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. Before we get started today, I just want to remind you that Roisin Meets is partnering with Body and Soul Festival, Ireland's most beautiful festival, filled with 3 days of music, art, culture and well-being. It takes place on the summer solstice weekend, that's June 22nd to the 24th in Ballinlough Castle in County Westmeath. 2018's edition includes Fever Ray, Chronix, Arca, John Hopkins playing live, Iron and Wine, Baxter Jury and James Holden and the Animal Spirit. Head to bodyandsoul.ie to pick up a final tier ticket and be sure to check out the Irish Times programme on the Woodland Stage, which takes place all day on Saturday and in well into the afternoon, and it's going to be a really great event, so do check it out if you're at Body and Soul. Now, my guest today is the writer Julia Kelly. She's the author of two novels, 2011's With My Lazy Eye and in 2014, The Playground. She's been shortlisted for the Kerry Group Irish Fiction Award and nominated as one of the Irish Book Awards Books of the Decade in 2010. It was while she was working on her first novel that Julia met a charismatic and successful artist, Charlie Whisker. He was 20 years older than her, and their relationship was passionate and extraordinary, each of them inspired by the other. Their friends were writers, artists and rock stars, and they lived a glamorous life of exhibitions, parties and concerts, and they became parents to a daughter they both adored. But Charlie suddenly changed, becoming forgetful, angry and confused. And in her latest book, Matchstick Men, she tells their story. It's a heartbreaking and at times an uncomfortably honest account of the mental disintegration of a brilliant man and its effect on his family. Julia came in to the studio to talk to me about the book, and I began by asking her about meeting Charlie Whisker for the very first time. Julia Kelly, thank you very much for coming in to talk about your really amazing book. I have to say, I've been recommending it to everyone, and I've been also warning them that it's very emotional and in some parts very distressing.
Okay, but we'll talk
about all of that. I mean that as a compliment, even though it is a hard read, but a really beautifully written account.
Thank you.
A beautifully written memoir. So I suppose just for people who haven't read it yet or just don't know anything about your story, maybe we could start at the beginning.
Sure.
With, I suppose you were this person who had this ambition to write something of a lost soul in your 30s, feeling like you hadn't really got on your path of life yet. You tried lots of different things and you end up in Anna McCarrig.
Yes.
Which I have to say I've never been to, and I'm very jealous. That was the beginning.
It's magical.
Yeah, it's a place that friends of mine go to. It's a writer's retreat, and it is one of those places where you never know who you'll end up meeting at it, and every night people sit around a dinner table. And you went up there having not written very much at all.
I got in by the skin of my teeth.
I'm thinking, how did you even get in there?
I'd written a few pieces. I worked for Rough Guides for a year, and I'd written a few kind of travel pieces, and not very strong. And I'd written a column for D-Side magazine that Melanie Morris used to edit. So I got in by the skin of my teeth, and I felt completely like a fraud when I arrived. So I was petrified. And it isn't just writers, there's artists, there's, you know, musicians, dancers, the whole lot. So it was incredibly intimidating initially. And for the first week, I worked quite hard. I kind of kept in my room, and the dinner in the evening is communal. So I was social for that time, but the rest of the time I was quite shy, kept to myself. But everybody kept talking about Charlie and Skippy. And I imagine that maybe Charlie was this kind of, you know, suntanned Californian man, and maybe Skippy was like a little tomboyish girl, or I had this image of them, and their names are so likable that I couldn't wait to meet them. And they turned out to be quite different to what I expected. Charlie was not Californian, and he was very thin, entirely bald, gaunt, a northerner, and under, when the first time I saw him, under his arm was a 6 foot long iguana that he'd snuck in, even though pets weren't allowed.
Skippy.
Yeah.
And you remember the first night then that you saw them both?
So vividly. And I couldn't, it wasn't exactly love at first sight, but I just had never met anyone quite like Charlie, so I couldn't compare him to anyone else. And he quite quickly gave me a lot of attention, and I really loved that. I found a sense of humour. He had a beautiful turn of phrase. He was very, very funny, very interesting. He also had read an awful lot of literature, 20 years older than me, and he kind of quickly became a mentor. We spent a lot of time together on the second week, and he he started reading my work, and he'd put kind of, you know, lines through. The first few pages would be edited and then they'd be completely blank, and there'd just be a PTO at the bottom of the page where he would have, on the far side of the page would be his version of how I should write. And he'd say, he'd tell me to write not just using the visual, but to write using all my senses. You know, what does something sound like? What does it feel like? What does it smell like? To turn things upside down, to make a mess, you know, to be brave and not be scared, not follow the conventions and rules. And he used to print out long lists of words for me to use, often quite kind of pretentious words, but and you know, when he developed Alzheimer's, that became, you know, an incredibly sad irony, because he really searches for words and he kind of struggles to finish sentences. But he very much taught me how to write.
In terms of timing for you, you were in a relationship at the time.
I was at the tail end of a relationship. I'd been with somebody for 7 years, and that he wanted to get married and I didn't. And actually, it was my big brother Nick who said, look, why don't you go up to
Anna McCarrick? Can I just mention that Nick is a singer with The Fat Lady Sings, yeah, and has also made a very lovely film recently too, and a very talented man. So I just shout out to Nick.
Oh, that's the drummer and the keeper. Yeah, it's a beautiful film. So Nick said, look, why don't you go up to Anna McCarrick? You know, maybe it'll help you start writing and just clear your head, get away from all this, and just give yourself some space. So I went up kind of in that situation. They say about Anna McCarrick, or somebody said while I was there, that it's a place where people are either breaking up or breaking down or having breakdowns. So it was a little bit.
Hooking up.
Well, possibly sometimes. That certainly wasn't kind of foremost in my mind. You know, I actually really did want to start work. And then Charlie had recently separated from his partner, Mairead. So he was kind of needing time out as well. So... that's how it started.
And it was, I mean, you said it wasn't love at first sight, but there was definitely a very intense connection.
There was a very big connection. I was just fascinated by him. I found him very, very original. I loved his old-fashioned way of describing things. I loved his stories of his childhood were so beautiful. I loved his knowledge. And I suppose you could be Freudian and say, I lost my father when he was 20, when I was 21, he was only 59, and I was feeling very lost when I arrived. So I really, he kind of seemed like the answer. And when I first started writing, and when I was working on my first book, you know, he was editing everything. And at the time, I thought, this is how I'm going to do this. This is how I become a writer. And it was only probably halfway through my second book that I realized that, you know, I have to find my own voice. I have to kind of, eventually, you have to take flight and become, kind of, you know, to just find your own way. But at the beginning, he completely helped me along.
Can we talk a little bit about your father, actually? Because you had a quite fraught relationship. I mean, your other two books are brilliant, too. I have to throw that in. And your debut with My Lazy Eye was just a really... And I know it was quite autobiographical, even though it was fiction. There was a lot of you in it, as there is with most people's first books.
I think I haven't really got much imagination, so I tend to always write from my own life.
I know.
This is my first purely non-fiction, but the other two are kind of loosely based on my own life.
But you were kind of... You didn't feel you lived up to your father. Father was a politician.
Yes, he was. He was also a linguist. I think he spoke five languages. He was exceptionally clever and very, very funny and very popular with his friends. And we all adored him. And when we were small, he wrote these stories called the Global Stories, and we'd all get into his bed and he'd read them to us at nighttime. And you know, it was all very harmonious while we were small. But as we got older, and I was a pain in the backside. I was very wild. And you know, as we got older, he was traveling a lot. He was, he had parents who were constantly telling him that he wasn't, you know, he wasn't good enough. And he was, you know, so that worked for him. But where, you know, I really needed a lot of encouragement. And our relationship was very much, you know, dependent on how I was doing at work, in school and exams. And I was just never, ever focused. I'm convinced I've got ADD, absolutely convinced, and it's just never been diagnosed. But I mean, I didn't listen in school even once, really. So we were kind of at loggerheads. And then he died really before I'd had a chance to kind of make it up to him. And I think if he were alive now, we'd get along very, very well. We'd be very close. So
going back to that, you did mention it yourself, and I don't want to be Freudian because I'm not a psychologist, but you feel there was something there in that, you know, Charlie was there 20 years older, very much someone who was teaching you a lot of things that you were trying to almost live up to a bit as well. Is there links there, do you see?
He couldn't, in so many ways, he couldn't have been more different to my dad, you know, but I always liked teachers. I always liked people who were, so I guess you could possibly say that. But in every other way, it was just about Charlie.
Reading about that, your relationship at the beginning, and this is before, we get into, and we'll talk about it obviously a lot, that he was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's and that had a big effect obviously on him, first of all, and on your relationship. But there's a bit of an Eliza Doolittle vibe going in there in terms of him wanting to tell you how to be and what to do, and even to the extent of, get laser eye surgery, grow your hair long, you had short hair when you met him, things like that.
Yeah.
So reading that, as the reader, sort of reading about that kind of relationship, there's a little bit of a feeling of controlling or kind of molding somebody into what they want them to be.
I think he kind of saw me as one of his blank canvases, and he was shaping me into what he thought I could be. He was kind of saw me as a project, and he kind of helped to transform me. But at the time, I felt I needed that and I wanted it. And it was only, it was about the first year of our relationship, we were incredibly happy when the dynamic was that way. With mentor and muse, that worked really, really well for, student and teacher. That worked very well for the first year and a half. And then when I, began to gain confidence, and particularly when I wanted to introduce him to my friends and go on holidays together and family and all that, he just did not want that. He felt he was older. He didn't have the energy for any of that. And that's kind of when we initially ran into problems. And I felt a little bit, it was a little controlling, because he wouldn't want to go out with me. So I went out on my own. But then he would often be very, very sulky when I came home, because we worked incredibly well on our own. When it was just the two of us together, watching Coronation Street, walking on the beach, writing, reading, painting, we worked incredibly well. We still do. We're exceptionally close. But he wasn't wild about it. He was quite shy, So my mother talked kind of frenetically the way I do, but Charlie would often, if we were in a kind of a restaurant, for instance, if my mum was talking or anyone was talking frenetically at him in a public setting, he'd get his food stuck in his throat and he'd have to go outside to regurgitate. And so I'd end up outside with him, and he'd want to go home, and he'd be on, so he was very very unhappy, very uncomfortable in social settings. The only things he really enjoyed were funerals.
He liked a good funeral.
Yeah, he didn't hate a barbecue baptism.
I interviewed Charlie a good few years
ago. Did you?
Yeah,
okay.
I did. And, I totally relate to the charismatic, the kind of very, very unusual person. I'd never met anyone like him. And one thing I find very moving about the cover of the book is one of his paintings.
His paintings. It's called Remembering Mother.
And I remember I went to an opening that he had. I think it was in Periscope Townhouse. And really the beautiful paintings, but also in the interview he told me that story that you recount so well in the book you maybe can tell us about it, because it has such a significance to his work, but also just to his life and how he saw the world as well. So he came across a young friend who had been murdered in Northern Ireland.
Charlie grew up during the Troubles, and he was walking home one 11th of July to a place called Pigeon Wood in Bangor. And the 11th of July is often a very tense night in the north, just ahead of the Orange Day parades on the 12th. And he came across this boy who was the younger brother of a friend of his who'd been shot in the head. And Charlie stayed with him while he died. And while Charlie was with him, the killers came back, saw Charlie, and Charlie recognised them. And then the following day, he brought the police to the spot where it had happened. And there was a lot of burnt matches, where Charlie had been kind of smoking and, frenetically. And he used this as a symbol of this young boy, Michael Brown, in all his paintings from that day onwards. And I felt it was a very appropriate metaphor for Alzheimer's as well, of a light going out and a fragility. And also Charlie looks a little bit like a matchstick because he's very thin and his beanie hats. And then he later had to leave Ireland because of, these two men got put away. But he never received any counselling or any help. So this was with him throughout his life. And he often cried about Michael and talked about him a lot. And we very sadly lost a baby at 17 weeks, a little girl called Lucia. And when she was born, we had a service for her and everything, and Charlie was at the birth, and he got, after she was born, he got incredibly depressed, and he got the death of this boy, you know, this boy dying in his arms, confused with Lucia dying. And he got the two things completely muddled. So he was mourning for both at the same time. And then his Alzheimer's kicked in properly.
So tell me about that. I mean, it was a very unusual relationship anyway, at the best of times. And like you say, not being able to share it with your family, with your friends, and make it, it had to be on its own terms. And, you know, so that's kind of difficult. There's one bit, because you there was a friendship there with Bono, with you two. There was a lot of that. So you had a lot of amazing times, it sounds like, us, you know, in Ali and Bono's house and going out with them. And one time you go to New York to the gigs. And there's one bit I found really distressing. And again, I sort of throughout the book, you're thinking maybe he's not well before, you know, he's not well, do you know, before he was diagnosed. But he said that you'd been having this great time and having talking to Bono all night. And outside the hotel, he said to you, by the way, you'd bad breath all night. And I didn't want to tell you. Yeah. And it was the time you had your first fight.
Yeah, I mean, that.
That, it really jumped out at me. I don't know why. I just thought
that's
was
quite
the worst.
Charlie, you know. Yeah, okay. But the first time when he heard me sing in Anna McCarrick and I sang a Leonard Cohen song, I thought I sang it quite tunefully. And that night he said to me, I'm just not sure you can sing. I'm just not, like, I don't want, you know, it just made me feel
See,
very
some
embarrassed.
Some people would run a mile from that, you know, immediately. It's funny, isn't it? Because some people would say, someone who immediately is showing me that they're willing to kind of tell me that I'm not quite there.
But he also, you know, adored, you know, he'd tell me every single day that he loved and adored me, and that he'd run into the sea if I ever left him. And he's, you know, that his humor, he kind of meant it in a, like, I wasn't thrilled on either occasion,
but it was dark humor.
I mean, he's got very, you know, he's very, very funny even now. So yeah, that those things didn't particularly bother me, as much as him not, like, him, you know, not being warm to my family and friends really upset me. And then he wasn't, you know, he found having a child later in life very tricky, and I found that tricky. And to be fair to Charlie, you know, when Ruby Mae came along, I fell completely in love with her. And then poor Charlie, who'd been on a pedestal, was kind of completely ignored, really, for a long time. And he then began kind of competing for her attentions. And it was all a little bit fraught often when the three of us are together.
Yeah, those are some of the most distressing parts of the book, I think, involving your daughter. I think they're the ones that kind of stopped me in my tracks, where I read it in one sitting, but there were moments when I had to sort of put it down because I found it very difficult. We'll maybe talk about that in a while. When did you start to notice then that something, he was always a very unusual character, and having met him, I totally, fascinating person, fascinating and so intelligent and so bright and so, yeah, so like somebody else. And I think it was the northern thing too, I think coming from the north, and like you say, his turn of phrase. And I remember when I met him that, and it stayed with me quite a long time afterwards, when he told me that story about Michael Brown, just realising how something like that happening to you at such a young age can stay so deeply with you and can inform. It obviously informed so much of his work, and it never really left him. I'm going off on a bit of a tangent.
Okay.
But for you then, when did you start to realise that not just him being sort of slightly an unusual character, something else was going on?
Okay, so it was because he was slightly unusual and never highly practical and, you know, a little bit eccentric. He was, you know, he was never particularly good at computers, never good with you know, ATM machines, all of those things.
You'd, and because you had to help him with lots of practical things anyway.
Well, kind of, and because of our age difference, and because I'm quite similar to my mum, and that I kind of wanted to help him a lot, so I'd end up doing a lot for him. And I thought, oh God, he's becoming really dependent on me and it's my fault. You know, I'm helping him too much and he's losing these skills because of me. But the first time I really knew that something was wrong was when he gave me a birthday card for my, I think it was my 40th birthday. And he had written, "Happy birthday, darling." But there was a letter missing from each word. And it upset me so much. I actually found the pen that he'd used, and I filled in the letters that night because we were having people over, and I didn't want to see it, and I didn't want them to see that he was making mistakes. And then the other time it was very relevant, or very all pertinent, was when we were abroad. He wasn't able to manage to find hotel rooms. He wasn't able to manage lifts. He was just Very, very disorientated with the money, with, you know, I remember staying in a room in New York, and we were trying to ring down to reception, and we rang the police, or Charlie rang the police at least a dozen times because he kept calling 911. It was an easy mistake to make. But and I put it down to his age. I put it down to jet lag. I put it down to maybe having a few drinks. Alzheimer's never crossed my mind for a long, long time.
But you had bought this huge, sounds like, house Bray. Was it on the seafront?
Yeah, it was a house we never should have bought.
Very expensive house very big. And the idea was that you would live this, you know, lovely life. But he wasn't...
And fill it with children.
Yeah, and he wasn't painting then, like, at that...
He was painting a little bit, but things were starting to go. And unfortunately, almost as soon as we moved in, the Celtic Tiger collapsed, and he had an exhibition where he didn't sell very much. I had just had Ruby May. It took a long time to have her. And we just kind of, it all became a little bit dark and a bit difficult. And unbeknownst to me, I thought he started painting over his paintings, his canvases in white, completely in white.
That must have been awful to see that.
Do you know, at that point, I've never known that much about art. I've always hated going to openings and things because I just feel completely out of my comfort zone. He used to always tease me about kind of saying ridiculous things. But anyway, at that point, I thought, no, Charlie knows what he's doing. And he was painting over work that he didn't feel was good enough. So I didn't notice for a long time. And it was only when there was one beautiful painting called Orange that had kind of pride of place in our house, when I noticed that wasn't on the wall, and I went to find it, and I noticed that had been painted over in white, then I knew that there was something seriously up. And I felt really, really guilty about that because, you know, just for his family, for his first family, and, you know, and for Charlie, I felt I should have noticed that, and I didn't. I suppose, even then, I was kind of in survival mode and just focused on Ruby May and just trying to keep the ship just from sinking, really. And we had very little money. We couldn't pay the mortgage, and it was a house we never should have bought. And then we very quickly couldn't afford it, and we couldn't fill it with kids because I couldn't. It was very difficult for me to have kids. So it all kind of started getting a little bit dark.
And when did it get so dark that you sort of had to end it?
I mean, it was a series of things. I think really since when Ruby May was a toddler, I remember saying to my sister, you know, that this isn't... There was one occasion when he was trying to wash... she was washing her teeth, and I heard from the dentist that you're not meant to rinse your mouth out when you're little, that it's better not to. And Charlie said, you're of course meant to rinse your mouth out. And he took the kind of the cruddy cup that that we hold all the toothbrushes in, and he took that and gave it to her, and I said, you can't use that, and he threw it at us, and he called us cunts. I'm not sure if I can say that word, but at that moment, you know, just there's a point I think in life where your heart just goes cold, and I just thought that this isn't any good for us. This is no good for Ruby May, and it's no good for me. And we need to get out of this. But at the same time, he was very dependent on me, and I adored him, and I thought I can't possibly abandon him, so I didn't really know what to do. But I worried that she was seeing an awful lot of stuff that was going to be very damaging to her long term.
I think what's very clear, and you write it so it's really well written, in that Charlie had obviously been going through his own sort of private hell for a long time before, aware that something was happening to him, but not knowing how to
talk about it.
And, you know, that's also a very painful part of the book, and especially with somebody who, like you say, had all the words, had all the art, was the most creative person, and for that, for him to be slipping away from him must have been just excruciatingly painful.
I think he was really, really frightened, and I think for a long time he knew something was wrong, but he didn't want to say it to me, even though we were very close. I think he was really, really scared, and I remember coming into his studio one day and seeing that he had laid out pictures from different parts of his life as if he was trying to make sense of things. And at that point he wasn't painting at all. You know, he was painting a little, but things were taking weeks. There were things like he used to paint Sweet Pea from Popeye, and he'd paint the body, but there'd be no head, or a chicken with two heads. And I remember him carving a pumpkin for Ruby May, at Halloween, and he carved two mouths and no nose, and it was on like two sets of eyes. It was just absolutely kind of bizarre. And she knew it was wrong, and we ended up putting it in the garden. She didn't want to put a candle in it, and she was embarrassed, and he was embarrassed. And so for a long time, even after his diagnosis, initially when he was diagnosed, he felt buoyant. You know, when he first found out, I just kind of plunged into real grief, and I just thought all I could see ahead was this kind of vortex of you know, doctor's visits, of, you know, medicine and brown envelopes, and I just thought there's no possible happy ending to this. I felt incredibly down. But Charlie, I remember crying the whole way home from St. James's, and Charlie was buoyant, and he said, Look, I know now. I know what's wrong. This is why I've been behaving this way. You know, and it was only 3 or 4 days later that I hit him, and he broke down, and he said, you know, I don't want to be the fool on the beach that everyone laughs at. You know, and he then showed how frightened he was, but initially he was buoyant to have found a reason for why he was behaving, to have an explanation.
Now, Charlie's has 2 daughters.
Two
other daughters, yes. I meant.
Yeah.
And Domino is one of them, and she came home for a holiday, and she features in the book. She came home for a holiday and ended up caring for her dad.
Yeah, so she came home, and initially Charlie moved into a house in Killiney. I was told that if Ruby May and I stayed living with him, I was told it was an urgent child protection issue, because there'd been a lot of kind of incidents of Charlie trying to wash her hands with scalding water, of trying to put her in a car seat upside down, the whole thing had become very, very
because
fraught.
Of his illness.
Because of his illness. I mean, he absolutely adored her and still adores her. This is all, you know, the stuff, I just would like to say that the stuff that is very personal and that seems exposing about Charlie, you know, I don't think Charlie, more than anyone, would not have wanted me to write a book about his illness that wasn't honest, you know. So there's no point in writing about Alzheimer's, I don't think, and only writing about the fun, happy sides of it. You know, I have to be honest and describe it all. And Charlie fully understood that from the outset.
Because you do mention in the book that he actually said to you, would you write about him?
He asked me to write a book about him. He wanted me to write about all his childhood stories, of which he's many. He felt very, very lonely initially. He felt his identity, you know. Charlie had a great career in America, and he had, you know, he was out and about, and he was, you know, kind of relatively high profile, and then he just felt invisible. And he felt his world had become very small. He wanted me to explain to people why he had behaved the way he had. And we both wanted Ruby May to understand in the future, when she's old enough to, I mean, she's trying to read it now, which isn't ideal, but she's nine, but
that's
it's not ideal, no, but she's kind of a little grown up, but for loads of reasons, so for all those reasons, and to be totally honest, I also wanted to give my side of the story, because I felt, I mean, with Alzheimer's, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And no matter how much I felt like I was doing for Charlie, I always felt I wasn't doing enough. And then, you know, I kind of heard from one particular source that I'd abandoned Charlie. And at that point, I was so close to having a breakdown. I mean, I just thought Ruby May is going to be left with two ill parents, you know, so I wanted to explain, I wanted people to see what the reality was like for us, and what the reality of this illness is like, and also to potentially help other people who are going through the same thing, particularly with the unique situation of having a small child with a partner with Alzheimer's.
I interviewed a woman called Tara Westover recently. I don't know if you've read her book called It's an Education.
No, I haven't.
It's a memoir, but she grew up in a very unusual circumstances with a very strange family. You can go and read it anyway. It's a brilliant book. But we were talking about the difficulty of memoir, and once you're telling your story or other people's story, there's other people involved. And I'm really curious about how it's been for you in terms of that, because you describe very well your motivations in terms of wanting to help other people, in terms of wanting to get the story down for Ruby May and for Charlie as well. For yourself too, you're a writer, and I know that you were trying to write a third novel and this kept pushing its way in, which makes sense because it was everything you were living.
Yeah.
But how has it been in terms of when you told people you were writing a book and, you know, Charlie's First Family, that kind of thing? How has that been?
So, I mean, it's early days because it's only just come out, and people are, there was certainly the press and my friends and family are being exceptionally lovely about it. And people who are also suffering from, you know, people who've read it, who've gone through something similar are being exceptionally lovely. I do, you know, I think it's possibly a little bit harder for Charlie's girls because they're seeing their dad in such a vulnerable light. But I didn't feel there was any other way I could write it. And, you know, ultimately, Ruby May is Charlie's daughter as well. And she needs to know what happened to us for her own life.
Has that been hard, though, Julia? Has it been hard? Have you had to have difficult conversations? Because I was saying earlier to somebody, having written sort of a little bit of memoir myself, in terms, not in anything like this league, but, you know, for example, talking about my dad's suicide, and there was members of my family who hadn't spoken about it to friends who then had to do it. There's a bit of that, isn't there? There's a bit of kind of you're plunging other people into.
And what it is, to be honest, I find that extremely difficult. And I have had one or two kind of hurtful things said to me. And the problem with that is I can only write. I'm only able to write from my own life, and honestly, I don't know how to write any other way. And I feel Charlie absolutely knows that about me. But I'm also incredibly soft and very way too sensitive. So it isn't a really happy. You know, it's good for my writing. It's not really good for life. You know, I get terribly upset if someone says something nasty. I get very, very upset. But at the same time, I have to realize that if I'm going to put myself out there, I have to develop a thicker skin. But it just doesn't come naturally.
And just going back to Domino, then coming back for that holiday, and then she actually moved in. It's really moving the way you write about that. And I think, you know, a tribute to those girls and to Domino particularly,
sure,
that she did that, because it was by no means, again, there's some really upsetting scenes in the book, particularly when you go over when he's just moved into the little cottage with Domino, and, you know, it's very hard again with your daughter and all that kind of thing. But that's quite a, I mean, I watched her on Instagram, you know, just posts that she would put up, and always feeling like what a wonderful, I mean, I know she would probably say that was my dad, of course I'm going to do it, but there's something very moving about that.
I mean when she first suggested it, I thought, oh, that's just going to be too much for her, and I thought it was too much for her to take on, and I felt very, very, you know, I felt a combination of grateful and really, really guilty about it. But I also thought, you know, she absolutely adores Ruby May, as does India, as does Mairead.
And India is his other daughter.
Who lives in California. And they, by them making that decision, they kind of gave Ruby May back her childhood. You know, she's, because at one point we were, you know, seeing Charlie twice a day. She was going over there in her pajamas. We were driving through the you know, dark at night, every night, never knowing what we were going to, you know, stumble upon, never knowing what mood he was going to be in or what was going to be happening. So her moving in with Charlie and looking after him really, you know, incredibly well, was a huge gesture, and it is basically, it gave Ruby May back her childhood for that year and a half. It made a massive difference to us, positive difference.
But eventually then Charlie had to go and to be cared for into a care home, which is where he is now, is that right?
Yeah, he's in a nursing home, and it's a beautiful place. He's always kind of dressed ready to go, as a lot of them are. It's very sweet. They're all not sweet,
wrong word. Charlie, again, when I remember him with the, and you described very well, with the Converse and the leather jacket.
Yeah,
and the
stick,
know,
the and the
cap.
Hat.
Yeah, like he had a definite look, and he still has that look.
He'll always be cool. He has such a look. But he walks up and down the corridors, and he often says to me when I come in, he says, I was nearly at your apartment. I nearly made it. And I just, at the last moment, I got lost. And he's just going up and down the corridor. But it's very interesting that so many people at that stage of Alzheimer's, there's a restlessness and there's a sense that things aren't right, and they don't know quite what isn't right. So a lot of them have their hats and coats and bags on. And when he first got moved to that ward, I'd arrive in, and your natural instinct when someone elderly is coming towards you is to stand back and let them out. And then, you know, alarms would go off, and the staff would be kind of, Dolores, come back here, you know, charging after them. So there is, there's a restlessness that goes on. But he's, now I'd say it's kind of a catch 22 that he's largely very, very placid and cheerful. And we, like, even last night, I was just going to lay in the bed beside him, and he was listening to Billie Holiday. And we were both doing impressions of storms and kind of old cats and very, very young cats and police cars and whistling and, you know, and we still have such a laugh together. He loves having his head massaged. He loves just physical tactile, you know, just having his hand held and rub. He loves ice cream and whiskey and also hot baths. Like there are things he that make him very, very happy. And Charlie used to be someone who was very into kind of aesthetics and, you know, the beautiful home, a younger partner, a kind of, you know, the nice car and all. None of that means anything to him, you know, and there is a real beauty of that kind of return to innocence with Alzheimer's. You know, I went walking with him recently, and there was a little cluster of daisies in Blackrock Park, a tiny little cluster of daisies. Most people would just walk, trample over, or kids might pull them out to make a daisy chain. But Charlie crouched down. He's like, look at those little guys. Aren't they just beautiful? And, you know, he's always had a real appreciation for nature, but he just seems to see colors more vividly now, and he has such he's incredibly lovable. I mean, all his anger is gone. When he occasionally gets angry now, you feel that's there's more of Charlie there, less Alzheimer's, and but so you're pleased that it's more of Charlie, but it's obviously a lot more distressing. And but largely he's incredibly benign, gentle, warm. I feel closer to him than I've ever felt. I feel, you know, I mean, it's not a romantic love anymore, but I feel I love him really, really intensely.
And what about Ruby Mae in terms of her relationship and how much of a relationship she can have with her dad?
She comes to see him usually once a week, and we have to keep it short because it can, you know, it can sometimes get, if she gets kind of too giddy, or, you know, if she gets in any way overexcited, it can be tricky. But she's so lovely with him. You know, she holds his hand to help him across the road. She puts on his boots. She talks in quite an adult way with him. You know, she kind of makes everything quiet around him as best she can. She's absolutely gorgeous with him. And, you know, even when he asks her repetitive questions, I mean, he generally just asks her, what age are you now, Nipe? What age are you now, Nipe? She'll answer him each time. She doesn't even, you know, she's learned all that. But if I leave the room, she can sometimes be a bit wary of him, and she'll want to come with me. So, but they still have a very, it's kind of beautiful to watch them together.
And you know, how is she now?
She's doing really, really well. You know, I think her nature, you know, she's quite an anxious kid. You know, to give you an example, she like last week they had a project at school, and they were all told to bring home or to bring in like bottle tops or toilet roll holders, and they each, in her little team of four, they all had to bring in different things. And so she got her bottle tops, and then she was frantically searching for all the other things. And I said, well, what are you doing? She goes, Mum, I have to, in case they forget, you know, in case the others, I need to get all of them. So she's quite adult in that way, and possibly because we've been on our own, she kind of, apparently this happens, I was talking to a counsellor who said this happens, they can kind of skip some milestones and become much older if that other parent is absent, that they, you know, so she's almost kind of co-existing with me. There's a better word for it, I can't think what it is, or is it a technical word?
The mother-daughter thing isn't as pronounced, it's a little exactly, bit more flatmates thing.
Flatmates, exactly that, or friends. And, you know, she wants me to go to bed at the same time as her, she goes absolutely ballistic if I don't, which isn't ideal. So she's generally, but she's a really spirited, fun, cheeky little, you know, she's bright, she's totally gorgeous, you know, but... you know, I know the freight train of Charlie dying is coming down the tracks, and there's nothing I can do to stop that. And I selfishly want him to live as long as he can so that she doesn't lose him when she's very young. But that's not fair to Charlie, because he would rather not live this way forever, I'm sure, if he had, you know, if he had a proper say in it.
What do you hope people get from it? I mean, I think you've been very honest about the difficulties, because it is difficult, because there's other people involved and you've chosen to tell it, and maybe other people mightn't be as comfortable with everything being out in the way it is. But
yeah.
I know you've weighed all that up and come to the conclusion that it was worth it. So what is it that you hope might
well, I
do?
Guess I hope... I suppose I'm telling it from the point of view of the carer as well. You know, I think when you become a carer to somebody, particularly someone you're in a relationship with, you're not only losing that person, but then you're actually taking on another person to look after. And if you have another child, you know, it's very, very tricky. And whatever decisions people make, I suppose I'd really like to feel that other people in, you know, if you have to decide about nursing homes and things like that, that people, you know, aren't judgmental, because, you know, until you walk in somebody else's shoes, you really don't know. I hope it may help other people, you know, with Alzheimer's. Someone with early onset yesterday apparently bought a copy in Black Rock, and he wants to read it and understand it. And aside from that, I have to be honest that it was really for Ruby May, Charlie and me that I wrote it.
And are you writing anything else now? Or
yeah,
is this...
so my next one, well, I'm just starting it, and it's going to be set in Kathmandu. But I won't say much more, because it kind of kills the magic a bit, doesn't it, to over talk about
and
it.
And have you developed this big imagination, or is it still very much based
on... I have no imagination. This is also going to be from my own life. So
you spent some time in Kathmandu?
I've never been to Kathmandu, but the story is of somebody dying abroad, which is what happened to my mum. So.
And we didn't speak about that, and we should, because it's also a very poignant part of the book. In the midst of all this, your mother died very suddenly.
Yeah.
Although... in some ways, she was such a traveller, and she died when she was away, and she was out for swimming and everything. But that was also a very big shock in the middle of this.
Oh, it was a massive shock. Her name was Delphine, which means dolphin. So it was, and her favourite thing was swimming in the sea. So it was a really beautiful way for her to go. It was incredibly...
Where was she again?
In the Galapagos. She was snorkelling in the Galapagos, and it was incredibly... distressing for us. And because she couldn't come home for a few weeks, it was, you know, there was a... It seemed very unreal, because she was always traveling as well. You know, she traveled so much after my father died. Like, her life kind of, she kind of blossomed in some ways personally, and she traveled a huge amount. So it was very, I needed to see her body when she came home. But I was also very frightened to see her, because I knew she'd been dead for a long time. And when I first saw her, I just said, that's not my mum. It didn't look like her at all. And she looked like a very cross woman. So it was pretty tough going, to be honest. Yeah. And I still miss her hugely. And my faith is kind of rocky enough, but often when people mention my mum, I think that's so strange, because I've just been having a conversation with her, and it's not on a conscious level at all, but I just feel she is just constantly present.
I think that's very normal as well.
Is it?
And I think so. I hear that a lot from friends. And so then you're going to revisit that and that relationship and that loss in your next book.
Yeah, and a neighbour actually recently died abroad as well. So it's going to be some elderly people travelling to an exotic place, and what happens when one of them dies.
Well, the book is called Matchstick Man. It's a beautiful book. I know we don't, I'm not supposed to judge books by their cover and all that, but it's one of Charlie's paintings. What's
yes,
it called?
It is. That's called Remembering Mother.
And it's really, really stunning, as all his work is and was, and with the matchstick there that he had as a motif from that very distressing childhood trauma that he experienced, and as you said earlier, never got really any help for. So something that he had to deal and suffer with all his life, having found his young friend like that.
Yeah.
What can I say that it's, you've done such a beautiful work, and it's so well written, and it's so compelling as a book. And as I said, it is distressing, and I don't mean I just mean that because I found it very emotionally hard going.
Yeah, I mean, people are also saying that they're reading it in one sitting, and that it's that they're laughing out loud as well. Mm. So I and also that it's uplifting. So I hope it isn't. I wouldn't want people to
Sorry,
think, oh,
maybe
this
it's
is
just
terribly.
Me. I did laugh a little bit, but
okay.
Mostly I was just very, I was kind of in awe of the honesty of it. There's no, you're unflinching as well in the way you talk about yourself, because you're not easy on yourself in the book either. You
no.
know, you're. It's just the anguish is very raw on the page, and you don't kind of give yourself a free pass on.
Well, things. I wasn't particularly proud of how I behaved throughout. You know, I don't think I'm a natural carer or a natural mother particularly. I think I'm floundering, as you know, I floundered my whole way through. I still am, you know, but I did the best I could, and I'm still trying to do the best I can.
And on some level, are you just, is Charlie aware of the books out in the world? Or is
yes,
kind of
he is. Now, because of his Alzheimer's, he'll say, oh, I still haven't seen a copy of this book. And it doesn't matter how many times I read it to him or show it to him, he won't remember the next visit. But he is absolutely, you know, aware of it. And he's very, very proud. And that, you know, that's it's kind of come full circle, because that's how we started. So,
and he's proud of you now.
Yeah, he is. He seems very proud. But we're very, very close.
Julia Kelly, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's all we have time for this week. Big thanks to my guest, Julia Kelly, and a reminder that her book, Matchstick Man, is out now. Today's podcast was produced by Jennifer Ryan with Rob O'Sullivan on sound. I'm Roisin Ingle, and I'll talk to you next time.